Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're digging into a really interesting case, Meyer v. United States. It's from 1979, but it still tells us a lot about medical negligence.
That's right, especially when something goes wrong in a medical procedure.
Exactly. It's a dental malpractice suit under the Federal Tort Claims Act, FTCA, and it really helps unpack what counts as legal fault when there's a bad outcome.
It really does. It involves Catherine Meyer, who sued the government after, well, a pretty serious complication following wisdom tooth surgery at a military clinic.
Okay, let's set the stage. What happened to Catherine Meyer?
Well, she needed her wisdom teeth out.
Mm-hmm.
And these weren't simple extractions. They were impacted. So it was, you know, more surgical.
Right, more complex.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And after the surgery, she ended up with a permanent lingual nerve damage.
Lingual nerve, so tongue nerve.
Yes, exactly. It meant she lost sensation and also her sense of taste permanently.
Wow, that's significant. So what was her legal argument? What did she claim went wrong?
She basically had two main claims. First, that the dentist, Dr. Aitken, was negligent during the procedure itself, that his actions caused the nerve damage, and second, that she wasn't properly warned about this specific risk, the nerve damage risk, before she agreed to the surgery. Lack of informed consent.
Got it. So negligence in performing the surgery and failure to inform about the risks.
Precisely.
So for this deep dive, our goal is really to understand those legal standards. What does it actually take to prove negligence? And what about informed consent in a case like this?
Yeah, we'll look at the community standard of care, what that means, proving causation, which is often, you know, a major hurdle.
And you mentioned something called res ipsa loquitur.
Right. We'll touch on why that legal idea, the thing speaks for itself, didn't really fit here.
Okay. And the big takeaway seems to be that a bad outcome, even a really terrible one, doesn't automatically mean legal negligence occurred.
That's the core lesson. It's a crucial distinction in malpractice law.
All right, let's get into the specifics then. You said impacted wisdom teeth, surgery. Paint us a clearer picture.
So yeah, impacted teeth, Dr. Aitken performs the extraction at the military clinic. Post-surgery, Meyer realizes she has this permanent nerve damage, loss of feeling, loss of taste on her tongue.
A really tough result. What evidence did she bring to court? What was her side?
Well, her argument focused on Dr. Aitken's actions during the surgery. She believes something he did, or maybe failed to do, directly caused that nerve injury.
Okay.
And then, reinforcing the other point, she maintained she just wasn't told this specific thing, permanent nerve damage, could happen.
Right. And the government's defense, what did they say?
The government, defending Dr. Aitken, basically said he followed the rules, that his techniques were standard practice for dentists doing this kind of surgery that in that area, Colorado, Denver.
So he met the standard of care?
That was their argument, yes.
Yeah.
And they also argued that he did tell her about the risks, including potential nerve damage, before the procedure.
Okay, so the court's job was to weigh these competing claims. What were the key legal questions they had to grapple with?
Two main ones, really. First, the negligence question. Did Dr. Aitken's performance fall below that accepted community standard of care for dentists in the Denver area at that time?
And breaking that down, what does negligence legally require someone to prove?
You generally need four things. First, a duty of care. The dentist-patient relationship establishes that. Pretty straightforward here.
Yep.
Second, a breach of that duty, meaning his actions didn't meet the professional standard expected in that community.
Right, the local standard.
Exactly. Third, causation, that the breach directly caused the injury. The nerve damage in this case.
That sounds like the tricky one.
It often is. And fourth, actual damages, which sadly were clear here, the permanent loss of sensation and taste. All four need to be proven.
And the second big legal issue was informed consent.
Yes, precisely. Was Meyer adequately informed about the potential risks before she agreed to the surgery? That's a separate duty the provider has.
And it's worth stressing again, right? Just because a known risk happens doesn't automatically mean negligence.
Absolutely crucial point. The law recognizes bad outcomes can happen even when care meets the standard.
Oh.
The question is, did the dentist act reasonably, and did the patient know the risks they were agreeing to?
So how did the court actually analyze this? Let's start with that community standard of care. What did they find?
Well, they looked closely at the expert testimony from both sides. Dentists came in and testified.
Right.
And the consensus from the experts seemed to be that Dr. Aitken's techniques, how he performed the extraction, were well within the accepted norms for the Denver dental community for that kind of complex procedure back then.
He wasn't doing anything rogue or experimental.
No, the evidence didn't suggest that. The court basically found he followed standard protocol for the time and place.
Okay.
And importantly, the court also heard and acknowledged expert testimony that this type of injury, lingual nerve damage, while not common, is a known potential complication.
Even if the surgery is done perfectly.
Even if it's done according to the standard of care, yes. It's an inherent risk of that kind of procedure, unfortunately.
Okay, that makes sense from a medical perspective. What about the informed consent part? Did the court think she was warned?
Here, the court looked at Dr. Aiken's usual practice. Evidence suggested he had a consistent routine. The court called it a habit and custom of specifically telling patients about the risk of nerve damage before wisdom tooth surgery.
A routine he followed.
The court concluded he likely did follow it with Meyer. They specifically found she was warned about the potential for nerve damage before consenting.
And they even quoted something about that habit.
Yes, the opinion says he acted in conformity with that long-established habit, so the court felt her consent was legally informed.
Okay, so standard of care met, informed consent given, but she still has this terrible injury. How did the court handle causation? Did his actions cause it even if they met the standard, or could they even determine that?
That's where it got really difficult for Meyer's case. The court essentially found she couldn't prove it was more likely than not that Dr. Aitken's actions, negligent or otherwise, actually caused the nerve damage.
What does more likely than not mean practically?
It's the burden of proof in civil cases, often called the preponderance of the evidence. It means tipping the scales, even slightly, past 50%. The court said the evidence presented just offered an equal choice of probabilities.
Equal choice, meaning?
Meaning it was basically just as likely that the nerve damage was an unavoidable, known complication of the surgery done properly as it was that it resulted from some specific mistake by Dr. Aiken. She couldn't tip the scales to show negligence was the probable cause.
Wow. That really highlights the difficulty in these cases, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. You can't just speculate. The plaintiff has to connect the dots with evidence showing the provider's action probably led to the harm. A possibility isn't enough.
Okay, now let's circle back to res ipsa loquitur. You said it didn't apply. Why not? It feels like that kind of injury might speak for itself.
Well, res ipsa usually applies when the injury is something that just doesn't normally happen unless someone was negligent. Think a surgical tool left inside a patient.
Right. Obvious error.
Exactly. But here, because lingual nerve damage is a known, albeit rare, risk of wisdom tooth surgery, even when done correctly.
Ah, so its occurrence doesn't automatically scream negligence.
Precisely. Since the injury could happen without negligence, the court said res ipsa loquitur wasn't appropriate. The injury itself didn't prove the mistake.
That clarifies it. It has to be something that ordinarily implies negligence.
Correct.
Now, you mentioned briefly a statute of limitations issue. Did that play a role?
The government did raise it, yeah. They argued she filed her lawsuit too late.
Right.
But the court disagreed. They ruled the clock started ticking, not when the surgery happened, but when Meyer actually discovered the injury and its permanence, which they pinpointed to around November 1974.
So she filed within 2 years of discovering the injury.
Yes, and under the FTCA rules relevant here, that made her filing timely. So she cleared that procedural hurdle even though she didn't win on the main claims.
Right. So she got her day in court on the substance of the case.
Exactly.
Okay, we've covered a lot. The facts, the legal standards, how the court applied them. Let's try to boil down the key takeaways from Meyer v. United States. What are the big lessons here?
I think the biggest one, the one we keep coming back to, is that a bad outcome doesn't automatically equal malpractice. There's a clear legal line between an unfortunate result and a breach of the standard of care causing that result.
Super important distinction. What else?
Second, proving causation is tough.
Mm-hmm.
Really tough. Plaintiffs have to show that specific action by the provider was the probable cause, not just a possible cause. The equal choice of probabilities language from the court really drives that home.
Yeah, that phrase sticks with you. An informed consent.
The case really highlights how important good informed consent practices are and documenting them. The court gave real weight to Dr. Aiken's established habit and custom. Clear communication about risks is key, legally and ethically.
So putting it all together, even with a really sympathetic injury, like Meyer's permanent loss of taste.
Sympathy isn't enough in court. You need solid evidence of both a breach of the standard of care and that the breach directly caused the harm. Without both, the claim fails.
That's the tough reality the legal system imposes. It has to rely on standards and proof, not just the outcome.
Exactly. Meyer is a classic illustration of that principle in action.
This has been incredibly helpful in understanding those nuances. So to wrap up, what's the final thought we should leave our listeners with?
I think the core message is clear. Bad results happen in medicine, but legal fault requires proof of substandard care and causation. And don't forget, informed consent, it's crucial. Documenting that conversation is vital for providers.
Definitely. And maybe one last thing to ponder. The court in 1979 really focused on that community standard in Denver. It makes you wonder, you know, with national guidelines being more common now and telemedicine blurring geographical lines.
That's a great point.
How might courts assess that standard of care today? Has the definition of the relevant community changed? Something interesting to think about as medicine continues to evolve.
Absolutely. The legal standards might have to adapt too. It's a fascinating question.
Well, thanks for walking us through this case. Really illuminating.
My pleasure. It's an important one.